Hey guys, this is Anna and you are listening to the Hannah Farooqui Show. Today we have with us Ali Salama connecting us from Canada. Ali is a fresh graduate from Ryerson University's entrepreneurship degree, former pro athlete, mental health ambassador, host of the world's exclusive youth leadership podcast focusing on empathy. He co-founded Visit Egypt, Egypt's largest travel media network, before dedicating his life to Empower Magazine, the first mental health magazine in Middle East. Currently, he works at Royal Bank of Canada by day while working on Empower Magazine by night. Ali's work has been recognized by the World Health Organization and numerous global mental health platforms. Welcome to the show, Ali.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Hannah. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
They're very well. Things are very, very, very well. I'm very excited to be on the show with you. And I've never done any show before with people from the Far East, whether India, Pakistan, or any other country in the Far East. And it's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to talk to you and explore a little bit more and, you know, mental health and how we can work, you know, as a collective, or how people could be a little bit more informed, if I may say, on the topic and why it's important and how it affects your life, and how right. It's not just something that, you know, people promote. It's more so of a very, very holistic type of everyday thing that we do in life. So absolutely. I'm really, really, really happy to be here.
Thank you so much for your time, and it's a delight to have you on a show.
Thank you.
Go so for it. Let's begin. Let's rewind a bit. So where were you born and how was your childhood like?
So I was born in Cairo, in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And my childhood was very, very, I would say, you know, very competitive. I had a very competitive childhood. I've always swam since I was maybe 3 years old. And I competed ever since I was a child. I didn't ever believe in mental health growing up because I was very, you know, very tough in my mind. But that all changed when I actually got diagnosed with a disorder, and I was, you know, not sure what was going on with my head. I was in panic mode all the time because mental illness is different from a mental health challenge. It's, you know, there's two different things when you're ill and when you're going through stress or when you're having a bad time. You know, illness is a state of like, you almost feel like that 24/7. I mean, you do feel like that 24/7. And then you don't know how to come out. You start to freak out a little bit because it becomes, sometimes people identify with that illness, like kind of like saying, oh, I'm Egyptian. Oh, I'm depressed. And that's something that it's so hard to not identify with, because when you're feeling like that all the time, you know, we don't know when it's going to end when you're in it. And that, like, I did not know growing that up that that would be the case. But, you know, growing up, it was very, I had a very loving family, and definitely what I want to say is that never in my life did I actually imagine that I would be, you know, doing this, what I'm doing right now. And nothing.
When were you diagnosed with it?
I was diagnosed when I was 18, turning 19. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you seek professional help, or how did you get to know that, okay, I'm feeling this way? How was it like?
Yeah, well, like, I'm very close with my mom, and me and my mom have always had a best friend type of relationship. I mean, there's nothing we never talk about. We're very open. It's a very, like, untraditional relationship in the Middle East, where you have very, like, high barriers or boundaries with your mom. Mm-hmm. With me, it was the absolute opposite. Anything, I would talk to my mom. And I think that as a man, it helped me out growing and expressing myself a lot, because I could never express myself ever. But why I say this is because when things started to go very wrong, my mom started realizing, and I started realizing, and it became almost like when things were not getting better and getting worse, and I started panicking. I remember one day I panicked so hard that I my mom wasn't living it with me at the time, and I freaked out when I went back home. I think I saw like ghosts and whatever, and you're talking to a 19-year-old, like, you're not talking to a kid. And like, when you're freaked out from your mind and you start hearing things and your thoughts are like very loud and you can't do whatever, it's very, very, very tough, because this is real. You're not in a movie. And that was when my mom was like, Ali, look, this has been going now for quite some time. There is no shame in going to speaking to somebody. I wish I could help you, but we will do this together and we will walk this walk together. And that's what happened. I went, of course, it wasn't that easy. I had to wait at university for like maybe 6 months in a waiting like phase, because there's it's not easy to get therapy and or counseling or professional help in Canada. Yes, it's free if you're in university, and some universities you're put on a waiting list. But I still had to wait, and in waiting I just kept like pushing and kept being close with my mom, kept trying to go out. But it was very hard because mentally and physically I was drained. I couldn't do the mundane daily things such as studying or working or doing a lot of things. So yeah, it was very, very, very tough, but I got through, and that's why when I realized that if I can get through it, I can make sure that I can help anybody to get through it as well.
That's actually great, because not everybody can will be able to navigate through it. Plus, you had a strong internal support system, like your mom was there. I think that added a great value. What do you think?
We almost think that we have to suffer alone and we have to do this alone. The only thing that we have to do alone is to take accountability over our own lives. That doesn't mean we don't share that with other people, you know? Like, I learned that, yeah, my friends will be there, but I have to lift myself up. But my friends will be there to make sure that I'm lifting myself up, and I will make sure that my friends are lifting themselves up. We take care of each other, but in a way, we're all responsible for ourselves. Now, that's a very different mentality than just we take care of each other. We're just hello, bye-bye from very distant, but we're to ourselves and we don't share. And that's the biggest thing that I learned through my struggle. I learned that, like, support systems are very important, but more so, you need to work on your support system way before you need them, because you don't want to run out of money. You want to always have money saved, so when you run out, you have to spend. That's exactly the same thing with support system. When you're very emotionally drained, you want to make sure that you have something that's strong that you can rely on, not to put that on a burden on your friends, but to always seek help in a way that is healthy and in a way that gives you the right and dignity as a human being, because I believe that, like, this is a human right to have some sort of a support system. But if you're not a good person, people that want to care and give you time for or not, because that's all based on unconditional love, and there's no giving, there's no like counting returns, there's no, I mean by counting returns I mean like counting favors, there's no that. You're there and that's it. You don't care about the other person's, like, what they're offering you. You love them unconditionally because of who they are. And that's what my support system around me are typically made out of. They're just, I don't care who they are. They have to share my values. They have to share what I stand up for. And I have to share what they stand up for. And we're always there for each other.
Ali, when you say about taking responsibility, taking charge or taking charge of your own self, it's very easy to say because it's, how do you actually do that?
That's a very good question. So how do you do that? You know, for women, I'll talk from a woman and from men and from a woman's standpoint. So for women, it's very important to take care of yourself by setting boundaries, by making sure that you're actively seeking out what is right for you and your heart, and you're not making sure that you're following a voice that's outside of your own. Feeling like you're empowered, feeling like your voice matters, that is how you take care of yourself, of course. And as well, for women, making sure that you feel beautiful, because you deserve to feel beautiful. And part of that is taking care of yourself in whichever way that may mean for you. Maybe that's just taking some time off. Maybe that's taking care of your mom. Maybe that's, everyone feels things in different ways. So that's my like advice for women. But for men, taking care of yourself means that you shouldn't burden yourself with things that, you know, you should bear it alone. Taking care of yourself means calling up a friend and asking them, hey, do you want to go out for a coffee, or do you want to go for shay, or do you want to go for whatever, hookah, whatever the hell it is in your culture or in our culture. For example, my culture is hookah. Maybe in the Western culture it's coffee or a beer, whatever that is. You need to take care of yourself in a way that allows you to understand that if you're drinking too much, if you're smoking, if you're working too much, if you're doing, this is hindering you. And being able to set that sort of inner map of, yes, if I go this direction, then I must know that my body is gonna like fatigue. So if I sleep for like 5 hours for 4 days in a row, the fifth day I won't be able to actually work as hard as I am working right now. So being able to take care of yourself is very, very, very subjective, and it means different to everybody. But for me, definitely, it means that I need to take care of my health. That means exercise and eat very well. And I need to surround myself with the right people, because if I do those two things, taking care of my health and taking care of my energy and people around me, my mental health is always going to be 100%.
Also, Ali, where do you draw a line between self-help and professional help?
Yeah. that's a very important thing. It's like drawing the line between a physiotherapist and a trainer, a personal trainer. When do you go to a physiotherapist and when do you go to a personal trainer, right? They both will train you in a way to do body movement functions. Well, the only difference is it's very simple. So if you are injured, severely injured, you won't go to a trainer because the trainer is meant to make you look like, the trainer does not have the same level of education as a physiotherapist. A physiotherapist will help you heal, will help you do specific exercises that are very, very intentional in getting your muscle back to recovery and even better than it was before. But if you go to a personal trainer, he just understands how to increase your fitness. That is not healing a muscle that needs repair, right? There's two different things. So self-help and professional help is the exact same thing. Self-help for me is if I want to improve my business or leadership skills or whatever. A skill that I feel already at my normal state at ease. But professional help, it's a mental illness. You have to understand that it is a permanent state of your mind, and it's not, you won't heal by reading a book. You need professional help, and that is different from having a or wanting the need to improve oneself, which can be categorized as self-help. It's a very, very sheer difference, and I always refer to the analogy of getting injured and going to a physiotherapist versus wanting to go to the gym and train with a personal trainer, which, you know, if you get injured and you go to a personal trainer, your likelihood of getting back or healing is zero to no, because it won't work.
So how did your friends and family members react to it when they got to know that you were diagnosed with mental health? Were they inviting? Were they supportive? And did that affect you?
To be honest, like, I didn't really get any response from, you know, family or friends. I mean, my family is very supportive, but I didn't, like, have that extreme, oh, we're with you support. Nor did I have all your crazy support, which is really good. I mean, I never really thought about that until you asked that question, but it meant a lot to me. I mean, I was never the guy that wanted support all the time. And I think that, like, what it meant to me personally was way more than what it really was, or because I just didn't expect that I would ever feel like so bad in my life. Like, I've always been feeling amazing all my life. I've always felt special, and when that happened, I realized that it was never about me. What about other people that go through that? What if people live their lives 24/7 feeling like that? Don't they have a voice? Why can't I, like, heal myself and make sure that if I am able to get through this suicidal period of my life, that I know for sure I can heal everybody that I ever that never had a voice before? And that's really what I did. It took years to do that. I say this and it's easy now, but it's not. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, and no matter how much I accomplished in my life, this was gonna always be my biggest accomplishment, is getting over that phase, because I don't undermine how hard it is for people to overcome mental illness. It's actually, that's people take their lives because of how hard it is, and some people never recover. And I live for the purpose of making sure that people know that there is a way out, and that the way out is not easy, but the way out is very bright. And the way out, they may not see it, but the way out is something that we didn't see it as well, being where they were. And that's my mission, to be honest.
So what made you start Mental Health Magazine? Like, when you are going through so much, I mean, the way you expressed it to me, I know it was very difficult for you. Amidst this, how did you got an idea, okay, I should start something like a magazine or some platform where you can just talk about it? How did this idea come?
Yeah, I mean, I realized that a lot of people aren't educated about mental health. I realized that there's really an ignorance, a lack of knowledge in that. And first of all, it started like a Facebook quotes page under the name Break the Silence, and I studied entrepreneurship and innovation. And what that meant was, like, in third year university, while I was going through therapy and that, I had a project that I needed to submit that basically proved that I had an idea that it worked. So what I did was, in my mind, the idea in my mind was, people are struggling in the Middle East, specifically in Egypt, with mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I prove that any idea worked? I had to test that people are struggling. So I put a Google form out called Share Your Story Anonymously, #BreakTheSilenceEgypt. And that form on Snapchat at the time went viral. Like, I got 140 responses in 3 days, and I got media coverage from Egypt, Germany, the UAE. And that's when I realized, okay, now I need to really get better and make sure that I offer something for those people that poured all their heart and soul out, all their darkest secrets, on the forum anonymously. I don't know who they are. I don't know where they are. I just know that those stories are very real and they're very severe and they need to be like addressed. So that's what I did. And I decided that once I got better, I would launch a magazine, and that magazine would build a community for all those people and for people that also have great well-being but want to even improve that. So people that, again, if we go back to the self-help example, people, you don't have to be mentally ill to care about your mental health. Just like you don't have to have like high cholesterol or blood pressure issues to care about your fitness and go to the gym. Mm. Mental health is mental health. Just like physical health is physical health. You take care of yourself, you eat like whatever you eat that is healthy because you like and you care and you love yourself. So I decided that this magazine does not need to address people with mental health issues, because that's very dark, right? If I'm just talking about depression all the time, like, why would people want to care about something if I'm always talking about the negative side of it? Why not empower people to really take care and take charge of their own like psychology and their own life, their quality of life, and address also illnesses? That's what I did. And I realized that the only way to get people to care about mental health is to make sure that the brand, the community, is desirable. Even people who don't agree or people who were the old me that never cared about mental health could start and maybe pay attention a little bit, because I wanted to make mental health cool. I want to make it trendy. I want to make it very desirable for people to open up and start exploring, how can I even make my life or quality of life better? The empower, E-M-P-W-R, E-M, if you reverse it, it becomes me. So it's actually me power. I'm targeting everyone that wants to feel that they have some sort of power over their life, whether it male, female, ungendered. I don't care about labels. I just want people to feel that they're alive and they have a really, 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 really good quality of life, merging their mental health and integrating that way of life that they want to live with their culture. So empower in 6 words does that exact thing. Empower merges mental health with culture. That's all what we do.
So what were the challenges? Were there any challenges for that matter during the launch or during this entire process?
Yeah, I mean, we still don't make money. So like, that's the biggest thing. We still don't make money. And that's why I got into podcasting, and I started the world's exclusive youth leadership podcast on empathy and community building. It's called Empathy Always Wins. And it just reached number one in Egypt. Wow. Under the category of nonprofit. Yeah. And basically what I'm doing right now is I'm building communities for corporates or individuals or companies using the podcasting platform, and I help people build communities using a very intimate approach. In that sense, it becomes a wellness initiative, and in that sense, I'm able to charge and get my mental health magazine up and running and get all our ambassadors that empower, our writers, like revenue, because I don't want people to just write because they care about mental health. Passion dies out. I don't believe that people will always keep volunteering out of the goodness of their heart. We need to eat, sleep, and care for ourselves and compensate, because that's part of self-care, right? So if I'm preaching what I need to preach, I need to be able to give people the means and resources enough, my people, and empower them to live their best quality of life. And that's why it's very important to make sure that that happens, and we monetize and we start really taking the company global. I mean, we have 12 ambassadors in across 10 different cities in 9 different countries. So we're doing very well with people, but we just need to get that off the ground and eventually go to Egypt and build our media company there, which is what I'm aiming to do.
Inshallah, you'll definitely get you there.
But the magazine does not target Egypt at all. And like, once the ambassadors start really writing, we have ambassadors in London, Cape Town, Toronto, Kuwait, Algeria, ambassadors pretty much everywhere. But in Egypt, the mental health, of course, perception is it's not good. I mean, if it was acceptable, I would have gotten some sort of partnership funding or whatever. But till now, it's not as let's put it that way. It's not like the fitness industry.
Why do you think mental health is so stigmatized?
Because people fear what they don't know. I come up to you, and I come up to maybe your mom, came up to my mom, who's from a different generation, and I tell her, hey, this thing disrupts your life, and you may feel like that, and like what the corona thing is happening nowadays. People are freaking out because they don't know what the hell it is. If people were educated, like people when they get cancer, I promise you, they do not freak out as much as like when they get like diagnosed with a mental illness, because at least they know if it's stage one, they can actually go get treatment and you know, people know it. People have heard it enough. People feel like, yeah, even though it's very unlikely that someone that you could get it, even if you get it, you'll know that it's treatable, and you know that if you treat it earlier, you won't die from it, right? So that's the difference. And it's funny because it's all about ignorance. People fear what they do not know. And when you empathize and when you can understand, you will never have that stigma attached to something that is now like an epidemic in the world. Like one in five, has a mental health lives with a mental health illness.
Also, in the larger part of Muslim community, it is perceived as a weakness of faith. What is your take on that?
No, not at all. I used to pray 5 times a day and I still had depression. That's a very flawed characteristic. Mental health, when you have a mental illness, your biology changes. Some people have seasonal depression. Like some people have seasonal body disorders due to the way that their body functions in with the changes of seasons. Now, if you want to tell me that, you know, God created us like that, but God created science, and God created like العلم نور, which stands for like education is light. So that's a very flawed mindset to say that mental health is a lack of faith. In fact, if you actually say that, it's haram to say that someone lacks faith because they have a mental illness, because that means that you have done a fitna or a fatwa of someone, and you may actually take someone's faith. I pity when I find people or scholars saying that mental health challenges or issues or problems or illnesses means that you lack of faith or that you're not close to God. I mean, I prayed 5 times a day and I was mentally ill, and that is a flaw in some of our communities and some of our scholars. I'm not saying our scholars are like that, but this is ignorant. Some people, your mind affects your biology when you're ill. What does that mean? That means that it's just like any other illness, like whatever. And even if you're close to God, sometimes seasonal things, trauma happens. Like all these things are not because you're not grateful for something that you have. Yes, you can be ill because you're not grateful and all these things, but let's look at it from a very bigger perspective. Because if we just look at the people that are ill because they're not happy with what they've been given in life and all that, they make a certain percentage of the population, but we're missing out on the larger picture, where people actually go through rape, trauma, accidents, very sudden experiences that alter the chemistry of their brains. And you think, like, is it fair for us to say that they're not close to God by having a mental illness? I mean, I'll leave that to you to answer. It really isn't. Even though with me being a practicing Muslim, I also encourage everybody, because in the West here, we do have LGBTQ communities and people that, you know, they belong to communities and they're very structured in what they believe and identify as. So, like, while I advocate for great well-being, why did I refer to those communities? Because I believe that just like in how we, you know, practice our Islam, when sadness comes upon us or when we feel certain ways, that doesn't mean God does not like us.
Exactly.
Every struggle. Like, if you remember how the Prophet felt when he went to Ghar Hira, when the angel kept telling him Iqra, like just one can only understand, like, come to, like, even think of how torturous this experience was. Imagine, like, you're hearing a voice of an angel that looks like a demon because of his wings, and it's very terrifying. You, like, this is intense. So, and at the end of the day, like, you know, you could argue that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, of course, like, he was, someone could argue he was hallucinating, and he went to his wife Khadija. He ran back home sweating and feeling, and like ghamiluni, or what he said, like cover me, you know. Some people may think, oh, he was full of, like, you know, whatever they think, but that just shows that our minds, our beliefs, our thoughts, everything plays into place. So again, and that was a very hard time for the Rasul, like, that wasn't easy accepting the message, and it was very, very, very holy and very precious. So again, my point is that when we go through hard things, God is testing us. And whether you want to take it in a way that God is sad from you or God is not happy from you, everything you go for, every pain you feel, is a testament of life. You know, if we didn't have things the hard way, we would never appreciate the beautiful things. Just like a wave, it has a peak and a trough.
Yeah.
To go to the peak, you have to go to the trough. And then it's a series of waves. And we see when someone's dead in a hospital, right? Are there to teach us very, very key lessons. And we have to be very mindful of that. And the moment that we say that, oh, God hates us, or the universe doesn't like us, or whatever the hell we want to call that higher spirit that we all believe in, we just need to understand that life is there to serve us. And in our darkest, deepest struggles, we become who we are meant to be. Yeah. And I think that, you know, if you look at the way the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam treated women, like, it says a lot. It says a lot about, you know, nowadays we're coming up with women empowerment and all these great things. But it's funny because, you know, and I don't mean to say that, I love my culture, I love the Middle East, but, you know, sometimes we don't treat the women the way they should be. And it's funny because our deen says otherwise, and our deen was the first deen to ever give women, you know, like, not to, well, I don't know if you remember, Wa'dil Banat, which was at a time where people in the Arab Peninsula and in the world used to bury their girls.
Like, right.
We were the first to come into civilization to prevent that. So it's funny how very things, history is very ironic. And all that I want to say is that it's beautiful to see that even though the Arab, like, peninsula or the Muslim world is not really living accordingly to our, like, religion per se, by giving women their rights and empowerment, just like Canada does or the US does. I mean, Canada more so than any country perhaps in the world. And I say this from experience and from friends, that youth women that are doing incredible things. And I've lived in the UK, I've lived in many countries, and I've never seen that sheer support from the government, from the system itself, to give women a voice. I mean, all, like, the grants, the government grants, the federal grants that I've gotten, everything was a woman helped me do that, and a woman, a 22-year-old woman helped me do that, and 22-year-old woman to have the power that she has in a country of, and being of Arab descendant, being Syrian, is very mind-blowing. And I just want to say that, that's pretty much what I want to say with our remarks on deen and emotions and feelings. Mm-hmm. And I say that because men, like the Rasul, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Sayyidina Muhammad, was very vulnerable. Very vulnerable.
Yeah.
In his stories, we have a lot to learn about vulnerability and masculinity from the Rasul. And that's something that I try to embody in my work. Of course, I can never be like 1/100 of the Prophet, but I can just try to at least learn and try to spread the message as much as I can, and be a messenger in a non-religious way, no matter my religion being Islam. So like in my messaging, you will find that, yeah, I'm talking to you about Islam right now because I know we're both Muslims, but when I speak to the public, that isn't going to be my main
focus. Right,
exactly. I address everybody from the LGBTQ, from everybody. And I believe that if we can address people and put like our religion and faith in our hearts, and that would be the most powerful statement we can do. And I think leading with example is the biggest estimate to that.
Yeah, also, again, it goes back to our religion. Our religion itself says, come to the common terms.
Exactly.
So yeah. It's all about that. You don't have to be always preachy and sound like, oh my God, that's a religious person. I don't know what he or she feels like when I talk about this. So it's all about being inviting, being open, and seeing everybody as humans first.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the way I think empathy, that's the theme of our show, Empathy Always Wins, is all about. Mm-hmm. It's about leading with empathy and deploying empathy. And when you have that, I mean, when you ask me who's the most empathetic leader you've ever known, I'll tell you, I learned that from the Prophet, you know. And maybe I wasn't the most religious person in the world growing up, but I did learn a lot. And I learned that, you know, loyalty, love, unconditional love, and true strength and power comes from caring for the purpose of caring, because we're human beings and we're born to connect and we're born to wire and we're born to help one another and we're born to be competitive too, and we're born to care for the well-being of others. But you know, there's a balance to everything, and I think empathy and empathetic leadership is what really comes to mind when we talk about this.
Ali, talking about mental health services in the Middle East, how accessible is it?
Well, that's the big issue, right? Because it's not really accessible. And what I mean, it's not accessible. The services are quite expensive, and automatically they rule out like 90% of the population. It's very hard to access great mental health services in the Middle East. Because of course we don't have like a trip advisor, right? We don't have the rating scale. We don't have all these things. That we don't have a board of a psychological governing board to actually prevent people from putting up, like, you know, people don't even know the difference between a life coach and a therapist is, and an average person in the Middle East. Like, we're still like miles behind, and that's the work that we're doing as a team, and I started with Empower. But it's no longer now my message. It's the whole team is now working on it. The whole team is now trying to empower people to understand and get better, well educated. And once we're well educated, people will be more incentivized to go into the psychological studies and study mental health and become mental health professionals and serve the region. But until that stigma ends, and until that stigma becomes a little bit more normalized, why would someone study psychology when like they'll be mocked up, right? Mm-hmm. Even if they want to do it. So it's a very cultural thing, and that's why our magazine is all about merging mental health with culture. It's not not providing better services. Services are already can be there. Education can be there. You can make a fund that can fly out very, very smart Egyptians or Middle Easterns to Canada, the UK, and educate them. But once they come back, no matter how educated they are, they won't get work. Why? Because the culture isn't ready to seek out help, right? So it's not about, I'm not tackling the medical realm, because the medical realm is there. I mean, I have access to, thank God, to some of the brightest mental health professionals in the world, but the issue is not having access to them. The issue is the people,
the mindsets, the
mindset.
Yeah.
How do you change a culture? How do you change the mindset? That's what Steve Jobs did with the Apple and the iPod, and I get to learn a lot from those great people, and I hope I can be one of them in changing, you know, how mental health is perceived in the world, in culture.
So Ali, we have almost reached to the end of the podcast, and now we have like quick final fives. So here's the first one. So what major life lesson did you ever had?
The major life lesson that I had was the only thing that will ever hinder your progress is a lack of humility, for sure. Always be humble and stay humble, and always try to make people feel and be important when they're around you, no matter how important you are, because the worst thing in the world is being around people that have great messages and feel intimidated by your presence. And you want to be very powerful, but you also want to be the least intimidating person in the room.
So what do you look forward to and what keeps you going?
Oh, that's a very good question. Like whenever I hire someone, I always look for leadership characteristics. I can never hire someone who isn't independent and who isn't a leader in their life. And my leader doesn't mean that they have to do a community service or all that stuff. A leader means that they take accountability. A leader means that when they're given a task, if there's a problem, they know how to solve it. A leader means that I can depend on them if I go on a trip or if I'm not available for a day. A leader means that if I go on a trip or if I'm available for a day, that they are able to take it and develop it and find ways and come and say, hey, I've done this and I've done that. A very proactive person. I only hire leaders and I only work with people that are accountable and people that care about the well-being of other people and people that share the same values as I do, which is authenticity, empathy, teamwork, passion, courage, and many others. I can send you a list because I actually have those values written down. I'm very, very, very religiously about them. Like, I go on very, very seriously about them in my life.
So, how do you see life and death?
Well, again, I'm a Muslim, so I see life as just a ride. I see death as also a beginning of a new infinite life. And I see life as a beautiful journey. I see life as a time where, yes, struggles and evil does exist and it does prevail in certain areas of the world. But I see that if you are strongly bonded to this light inside of you, wanna call it Allah, wanna call it the light, the universe, you know, everyone inside of us has a manifestation of God because God created everyone. And or you wanna call it the universe, like whatever. In each and every single one of us, in our hearts, there's a manifestation of God. And that's why sometimes when we meet someone or when someone says something, we say, oh, subhanAllah, subhanAllah. We see God's wisdom and beauty in every single human being. And that just means something. That means that none of us is way more important than another person. We all have talents and skill sets that can make us shine and be the number one people in the world in whatever we do. Because God did not create us differently. That's what I believe in. When you say life and death, I come to think of death as a place where we meet that source of energy. We get to experience this light in a very transcending way. And I'm actually like happy. I'm excited for death just as I'm excited for life. I never want my death to be a funeral or a sad place. I want people to celebrate my life. And I hate the fact that, you know, people wear black in death and all that things. I think that mourning and grieving is something that I don't want people to do when I'm gone, because I feel like life for me is such a blast. And I want, of course, it was never always a blast. It's always just been a blast for the past year, but I've worked so hard on making that, like, and really canceling anyone and energy out of my life that never gave or served that the core values that I was talking about. And I think in doing that, I think life has to be honored and cherished. And of course, when people go away, you are sad. But I think that if we can really understand that that's something that will always happen, and we have to celebrate the fact that this person gave that much in life. And I'm just working for my legacy. And I think my legacy is making sure that people live better quality lives. And it's way bigger than Ali. It's way bigger than my name. It's something that I want people, just like what Steve Jobs has done. Steve Jobs left billions of people using an iPhone. That's, like, no one cares about Steve. I mean, we all do, but like, sooner or later, just like Michael, we'll all be forgotten. Like, no matter how crazy we are, or crazy big, crazy influential, we're really not that important. What is really important is the message and the legacy. And that's all that I focus on from day one, because I've been reading since I was 17. Mm-hmm. I've been reading since I was 17, some of the greatest people in the world, some of the greatest minds, and they all have one thing in common. They all achieved great things. And you know what? While I may be also wanting to achieve great things, it's never because of my name. It's because of the impact that I want to leave way well beyond when I'm forgotten, because I know I'm going to be forgotten and I know I'm not going to be important. And I always know that that's what keeps me humble. That's what keeps me very close to the family that I have and the friends that I have. Because at the end of the day, like, no matter how famous, how wealthy, how whatever you get, at the end of the day, you're not really important. even if people have millions of fans like standing up outside, we will all die, we will all be gone. And that's what I mean by humility. When you ask me like what is the number one lesson, always stay humble, because at the end of the day, no matter how big God gives you of a gift, no matter whatever you have, at the end of the day, we'll all end up in the same place.
And what do you want to be remembered as?
I want to be remembered as the person that gave people their voice to shine. That's it.
And what's your final message to all those who are listening?
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, I was feeling very suicidal at one point in my life. And at one point in my life, I never felt that I was enough, and I hated myself. And I was diagnosed with clinical depression and identity crisis. And I'm not proud saying that, but I only say that because if you are too going through a very tough time, if you have been sexually abused, assaulted, if you have been in severe trauma, struggle, or if you felt like life is worthless, just know that while you may not see that other side, like I was really there standing by your side too, feeling that. And you just have to hold on to one string of light. If something in your life is giving you that light, be it your dog. You know, my mom has 6 dogs. She, mm-hmm. for her, dogs work very, very, and that's her refuge. If it's dogs, if it's praying, if it's watching a movie, if it's something, hold on to that string and try to focus all your energy on that, really that small dot. But when you focus that energy on that small dot, guess what it becomes? It becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And whatever is outside of that small dot, cancel it, cut it out. Just like you would cut out someone who's coming to harm your child and be very ruthlessly ferocious about that. The more you care about that small dot, the more you will be able to truly give yourself and love yourself. And if that means taking harsh decisions in your life, take them. Because if you're not feeling well, I don't care how good, wealthy, loved you are. If you don't love yourself, your life will be very, very, very tough. And it will be very hard to bear. So I highly recommend everyone who's going through that tough time to understand that I'm no special, I'm no different. I just decided that I want to put up a blog, and I called it a magazine, and I got people to believe in it because I believe in it. And if you believe in yourself, other people will do, whether it's a job interview, whether it's a marriage, whether it's whatever. Make sure that you live the quality of life you intend, because if you don't ask, you'll never get. And start by asking yourself to show up for yourself and show up for yourself. That's all I have to say.
Wow, that was beautifully said. Thank you so much, Ali, for connecting with us. It was really a great conversation, and it was really a delight to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Wishing you all the happiness, goodness, and lots of barakah in all that you're doing. We'll see you shining more in the future, inshallah.
Thank you, Hannah. God bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So yeah, that was Ali Salama with us. You can definitely get in touch with him. I'm going to put all his links in the description box. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. And if you found this episode insightful and informative, then please do share it with your friends and family. Let's together spread an awareness around. And yes, remember to be a better version of yourself. Learn, grow, and spread good vibes.